It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Rob Ferret will be back on Monday. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll look at President Trump's decision to cancel an across-the-board pay raise for federal workers. Right now, Wisconsin has gotten a much-needed break from the rain, but some areas, including those in the western part of the state, are still dealing with flooding and rising rivers. And more rain is in the forecast. Rich Kramer is a WPR reporter based in Eau Claire. He's here to give us an update. Hi, Rich.
Hi, Judith.
So what areas are still dealing with the worst flooding?
The worst flooding is still making its way through the Kickapoo and Baraboo River systems. There was really extreme flooding that happened. This is all from rains that came Monday night. Up to a foot of rain was dropped on the central portions of the state. I mean, there was a lot of local flooding going on, too, but the pictures that we've been seeing coming off of the Kickapoo and the Baraboo Rivers are just amazing. According to river gauges that the National Weather Service has, there was records broken at Steuben, Gays Mills, and Reedstown, and on the Baraboo River at Baraboo, the record was broken as well. So the water is still making its way through those systems, and there's still high water.
You've been talking with meteorologists around the state. What does the weekend forecast look like?
Well, it's going to be wet. It looks like there's a storm system that's down in the Iowa area, and it looks like it's going to kind of push up. There's a low that's going to push up, and it's going to send showers and thunderstorms. So this afternoon, it looks like there's a potential for some severe weather. They're thinking it's going to be mostly wind and hail and lightning. There's some rain coming too, but then a system of showers and thunderstorms will push through Saturday and Sunday. So what we're hearing now is that it could be another 2 inches of rain over the weekend for the Madison area. Southwest of that, 3 inches. So parts of the state that are already saturated, normally they say they wouldn't put out a flash flood warning for that amount, but since there's so much water already, the rivers and streams can't handle much more.
Yeah. And briefly, Rich, it is a holiday weekend for people traveling, especially those in western Wisconsin. Do we know how they might be impacted?
Well, if anyone's wondering, check it's 511gov. It's the Department of Transportation's website where you can get a pretty updated list of closures, but it basically steer clear of the Kickapoo River and Baraboo River area. A lot of road closures and highway closures down there.
Well, Rich, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll keep an eye on the weather and the flooding.
Yeah, here's hoping for the best. Thanks, Judith.
Rich Kramer is a WPR reporter in Eau Claire. He gave us an update on the weather outlook after a week of storms. And WPR has been providing ongoing coverage of weather, storms, and flooding across the state. You can find that information at WPR.org. Now, President Trump announced yesterday that he's canceling scheduled pay raises for federal employees, citing the need to limit government spending. The 2.1% raise was slated to take effect for nearly 2 million workers in January of next year. The decision, which exempts members of the military, is being criticized by Democrats, federal employee unions, and also by some Republicans. Kate Davidson is a reporter covering the Federal Reserve and U.S. economy for The Wall Street Journal. Kate, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, how and when were these scheduled pay raises put in place?
Well, the raises are automatic. They happen every year, and they're set to take effect on January 1st, 2019. And so what the president said yesterday is that he's scrapping those planned automatic increases.
And what reasoning did he give for doing that?
Well, he said, in essence, what he did with this letter to Congress is say that he's invoking his emergency authority. He's allowed to do this, and the rationale is essentially that it's an emergency. The president is allowed to do this in case of national emergency or serious economic conditions. And what he said was, you know, this is a time of rising, budget constraints. He didn't single out rising deficits, but that's sort of what, if you read between the lines, that's what he's suggesting is happening. And we need to rein in federal spending. This is one way to do it.
On the other hand, the president has been touting a very strong, robust economy that he says, you know, this isn't a blip. This is going to continue. So does that really square with using that reasoning?
No, exactly. That's what kind of makes this a little bit unusual. Certainly, President Obama, this is something, a tool that he used in 2009. He said that he was going to hold these pay increases at 2%. He didn't freeze pay, as President Trump is doing, but hold them at 2% because, of course, the economy was not doing so great then. Much different situation now. And right, we had the president just this week pointing to the latest GDP numbers, saying how strong they were. So it is a little bit odd timing there.
One group that won't be affected by this is members of the military. What happens with their salaries?
Right. They're set to get a 2.6% increase, and this order would only apply to civilian workers. There's about more than 2 million of those, so certainly a large number, but right, the military would not be affected.
And unions, not surprisingly, who represent federal workers have been saying that, you know, they're coming out against this. They've been very vocally critical of it. Do they have any recourse against this decision by the president?
Well, basically, at this point, the ball is in Congress's court. And so I think it is important to note that Congress is probably pretty likely to override this decision. The Senate has already passed a spending bill that would give federal workers a 1.9% raise, and that was passed on a bipartisan basis, 96-2. So overwhelmingly, the Senate is saying we should give federal workers an increase. Now, the House has to also pass a spending bill, and then the two sides, House and Senate, have to work together to combine the measure into one bill, and then the president has to sign it. So I think it's probably pretty likely that the House will come along and approve some kind of raise, and the president would have to then veto the bill if he felt so strongly that workers should not get this raise. So I think that unions probably know that it's likely that there'll be some kind of increase. But this is, it's a really important message the president is sending about, his view of the government and the federal workforce and what should be happening right now to them.
We're talking with Kate Davidson. She covers the Federal Reserve and U.S. economy for the Wall Street Journal. And we're talking about President Trump's announcement that he is canceling scheduled pay raises for federal workers. Do we have a sense, Kate, how much this would save the government if the president is able to get his way on this issue?
Yeah, so it was a little bit tricky. I tried to track down an accurate figure, and the White House didn't have one. OMB didn't have one. But I've seen some estimates say that it would be around $30 billion next year. And that's for the across-the-board pay increases. There's also something that's called locality pay, and there's a provision in federal law that essentially says federal workers ought to get comparable pay to what private sector workers doing the same jobs would get based on where they live. So, $50,000 is not the same in New York City as it is in Fish Creek, Wisconsin. So they make certain adjustments there. And the president also said he would get rid of the locality pay increase.
It also seems that not only does it depend, how much someone in a similar job would be making in an area, cost of living is very, very different in different areas. Is that part of the locality pay as well?
Yeah, exactly. It's all kind of factored into that.
So you said that Congress has a lot of say in this. What are we hearing from members of Congress about the president's announcement?
Well, perhaps not surprisingly, Democrats came out strongly against this yesterday. Many of them issued statements saying, pointing in particular to the tax cut that was passed late last year and saying, we just passed this massive tax cut, and now we're turning around and we're arguing that, we need to really rein in spending. Of course, the tax cut, congressional scorekeepers have estimated that would cost the government, could be more than $1 trillion over the next several years. So, we just did this, and now we're saying, we're spending too much. We need to freeze pay increases for federal workers. So that's their argument. They're really unhappy about it. But interestingly, we heard from at least one Republican who's facing a really tough reelection challenger right now in Northern Virginia, which, of course, right outside Washington, mm-hmm. D.C., a lot of federal workers live there. And that's Representative Barbara Comstock. She came out and said, hey, wait a minute. We shouldn't be getting rid of these pay increases. I think it's a politically difficult issue for her if her constituents are feeling like this is something that's being taken away from them. So she's a Republican who's in kind of a tough spot on this.
Well, Kate, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Kate Davidson covers the Federal Reserve and the U.S. economy for the Wall Street Journal. She talked with us about President Trump canceling scheduled pay raises for federal employees. Those would have taken effect in January. And a small correction when we were talking about where you can find information about roadways and flooding. The website is 511wi.gov. That's 511wi.gov. Now, for many people, crossing the street safely doesn't take much more than looking up from a phone, checking both ways to make sure that there's no traffic coming, and if there's a traffic light, that it's in their favor. But for people who are blind or visually impaired, it's another story. An article from the UW Journalism Project called The Observatory took a look at audible traffic signals and what they mean for people who are blind and visually impaired. Denise Jess is the executive director of the Wisconsin Council of the Blind and Visually Impaired, based here in Madison. Denise, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
Well, you are legally blind, and in the Observatory article, you shared what it's like walking to work each day. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So I am legally blind, which means I have some limited vision. And so walking to work every day is really an exercise in mindfulness, I think I would describe it as. That, you know, getting preoccupied and having my head somewhere else isn't a luxury that I can afford, because I need to practice just acute awareness of my surroundings so that I can safely cross streets and navigate sidewalks. Even though I use a white cane, that's not an assurance that I'm going to get to and from safely. So when I come up to an intersection, whether it's a signalized one or not, and I tend to use signalized intersections because they at least cue the cars that someone is wanting to cross, I can never really fully trust that cars are going to stop. So I am always paying attention to where I hear traffic flow and listening for cars to stop if they are, you know, in the lanes where I would need to be crossing. So there's often, and research shows this is true too for other folks with visual impairment, that we delay our entrance onto the crosswalk because we're just checking so many times, checking, rechecking, is it really safe to cross? And by that time, you know, the light might be starting to flash already, which reduces our safe passage time. So, you know, 2-3 times a day, depending on how many meetings I'm running to and from, you know, that's the process of getting across a street safely. If it's an unfamiliar one and I don't know the traffic pattern, I don't know if there's a left turn lane or a right turn lane. You know, I may wait a light or two cycle before I cross. So people are looking at me like, "What, lady, are you going to cross?" No, not yet. Mm-hmm. You know, I haven't navigated this enough yet.
So the article in the Observatory focused on audible traffic signals. What exactly are those?
Oh, they're so awesome. Whenever I run across one, I want to do cartwheels right there in the street. They use an audible sound to help pedestrians cross safely. So right outside the WPR studios here, you've got two of them. And there are times when I'm running errands or meetings on campus where I'll intentionally go to those intersections to cross, because as soon as I hit the button for the walk, I get a tactile. It will give a little shake. So I'll know that I've hit the button correctly. And then it will tell me either wait because the traffic is still running and I can't cross, or it will tell me the walk light is on to cross University or park or wherever I am. And that is an amazingly liberating experience to be able to use those audible signals, because they're giving me information. You know, a lot of times if you come up to a regular traffic signal and you press the button, if there is a button, you don't know, is it working? Is it not working? There's no feedback loop. So this tactile little shake and then the words wait or the walk sign is on give me the information that I need, and I can actually start proceeding through the intersection sooner. And the research again shows that when audible signals are used, people who are visually impaired start their progression across the street sooner and can actually capitalize on that whole walk light time period.
Let's take a listen to what that sounds like.
Wait. Wait.
So how common are those audible traffic signals in communities around Wisconsin?
Sadly, they're not very common. The best practice is to install them at the time that a new signal goes in, and that is the most cost-effective. And, you know, if communities truly value inclusion and accessibility for all people, because not only people who are visually impaired benefit from the signals, many other groups do as well. So really forward-thinking communities will say, let's just simply install one right away when we're putting this new signal in. I don't know many communities that do that. And so, unfortunately, then things have to get retrofitted later, which is much more costly and usually comes after there's an incident or people are feeling unsafe and having to prove that that's a dangerous intersection.
We're talking with Denise Jess right now. She's the executive director of the Wisconsin Council of the Blind and Visually Impaired. We're talking about how important audible traffic signals can be to people when they are trying to safely cross the street. Denise, do we have a sense how many people in Wisconsin are considered to be blind or visually impaired?
Sure. There are at least 100,000 people in the state of Wisconsin who have significant visual impairment. So that means, you know, anything that is less than 20 over 70 in the good eye. And then there are a percentage of those people like me who are legally blind and other folks who are fully blind. And that ranges from children through our aging adults. And as we know from looking at things like macular degeneration and retinopathy, that our aging adults who may have had normal vision throughout their lives are now also joining the ranks of those of us who are blind and visually impaired. So we'll see those numbers continually increase with the baby boomer population beginning to age. Mm.
Ideally, I think there would be an audible traffic signal at every intersection, but,
yeah,
you know, that doesn't sound like it's realistically going to happen at any time in the future. In lieu of that, are there ways that drivers and pedestrians can kind of be partners in safety at intersections?
Yeah, they really can. So, you know, I know that my colleagues and friends and clients who are visually impaired take street crossing really seriously. Sometimes people will say, well, you should be more careful. we're so hypervigilant about crossing. I don't know anybody that takes that in a cavalier way. So I think understanding that we're putting a lot of effort into crossing safely. For those of us who carry a white cane or use a service animal, that is just a vital universal signal to other pedestrians and to drivers that we don't see you. And in Wisconsin, and actually in all 50 states, there's a white cane law that requires that drivers stop for someone using a white cane, whether, you know, they're in the crosswalk or, you know, mid-block. In Wisconsin, it's within 10 feet of that walker. And it is the driver's responsibility to be paying attention and have an awareness of their surroundings and to make that stop for someone carrying a white cane. And if we work together, we could have a really good collaboration and people could be much safer.
It does seem really concerning that we're seeing constantly the number of distracted drivers,
yes,
going up, not to mention drunk driving and drugged driving, but distractions from phones, from
exactly
everything else. That has to be really scary for someone who's visually impaired.
It is. You know, when I talk with my colleagues and friends and in my own experience, I can hardly think of a day that has gone by in my life where I didn't have that little extra heartbeat moment. So it's not uncommon with one of the places where I cross going to work in the morning, even though I'm using a signalized intersection, for drivers to run that. They get caught in the run the red. So they get caught in the flow of traffic. They're looking at their phone or applying mascara or whatever things people do in their mm-hmm. cars on their way to and from work. And they run the red. And usually it's two or three cars that run. And so, you know, I have to wait until I truly believe it's as safe as possible. just out of curiosity, the month of February, I decided to keep a tally. So my morning commute, my afternoon commute, how many days was it that I didn't have to deal with a car running the red? Out of the, in the month of February, with those two times a day crossing my street, there was one day where no one ran the red. And that was stunning and disturbing to me to actually see that written down.
Well, Denise, as we wrap up, I know that sometimes people would like to assist someone with a disability, but they're not sure how to. So what I'd like to ask you is, what should sighted people do if they see a person who might be blind or visually impaired trying to cross the street? What's the best offer of help that we can give?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. So really, we want to support the empowerment of that person. So asking them, you know, is there a way that I could be helpful? Or would you like any assistance? And then taking the cue from the person who's blind and visually impaired directly, because in my case, I don't need someone to grab my arm and would prefer not to have that happen. I will just say, will you walk with me, or will you tell me when the light has changed? Other folks would feel much more comfortable having a sighted guide, so someone that they could take their arm and walk across. Other folks are like, no, I've got it. I'm good to go. So the most empowering thing is to ask, not ignore. I've been at intersections where I've stood with next to someone, and I've outright asked, would you tell me when the light changes? And they walk away. okay. What do I do with that? And then other times where folks have grabbed my arm, let me help you. But the times when I have felt just really empowered is when someone's asked me and I've been able to let them know what would be most supportive.
Well, Denise, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you, Judith. This has been a delight.
Denise Jess is the executive director of the Wisconsin Council of the Blind and Visually Impaired. She joined us to talk about audible traffic signals and how important they can be for people with a sight disability. It's Food Friday, and it's a great time of year to enjoy a late summer evening and fire up the backyard grill with family and friends, knowing full well that whatever comes off the grill will be delicious. Well, that is, as long as the one wearing the apron and wielding the tongs knows what they're doing. We thought it was a great time to revisit a conversation that Kate Archer-Kent and I had with Dave Heide. He's executive chef and owner of Charlie's on Main in Oregon and Liliana's in Fitchburg. Grilling has really become a year-round way to cook, even way up north here in Wisconsin. Why do you think Americans love to grill so much?
I don't know. I think it's two big things. One, obviously, like the flavor. You know, everyone loves the smokiness. Although I will say, and we'll talk about this, I'm sure, later, but grilling may not even be one of the best ways to actually cook a meat in terms of a dry heat method. But the flavor that you get from it is incredible. I think the biggest reason why grilling is so fun is the kind of social aspect of it. You know, the like hanging around, everyone has a beer and the brats and communal eating. It's something that we don't do very often anymore. A lot of times when we do eat, it's going out to a restaurant and everyone's kind of quiet and huddled around their single plate. And then, you know, when you're on the barbecue, it's everyone kind of sitting and chatting and snacking.
I thought you were going to say it was that primal fire thing with meat on the fire.
Oh, there's that too.
That's what I love.
Oh, there's that too. But honestly, you know, we get that in so much other cooking
That's
nowadays
true.
Too. You know, everything is kind of primal in how we eat.
Well, let's cut right to the chase. What meat is absolutely right for the grill?
Well, beef, honestly, is like probably one of the best. Beef and pork. Ribeye is probably my favorite cut, if I were going to have one cut, and that's because it has enough marbling and fat in it to really grill well. You know, you want to stay away from things like filet mignon or light cuts of meat, and that's because they don't have enough fat in them to really withstand that dry cooking method that I just mentioned.
And the searing as well that comes up from the grill.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's some searing, but, you know, searing is probably one of the you don't get that much searing ability from the grill itself. I mean, the only part that actually sears the meat on a grill are just where those bars are on your grill. So if you really want a great sear, actually one of the best methods is pan frying your steak. So, the big thing for grilling, though, for me is, again, it's just about getting that flavor and the smokiness and that kind of caramelization and kind of carbony, smoky flavor.
And I have to say, I love putting chicken on the grill. One of the things that I've been doing, I was telling Kate about this earlier, I was going to do it today, but the weather's not cooperating, is I get a spatchcocked chicken. So, you know, ask the butcher to flatten it out. So it kind of looks like a chicken version of a little bearskin rug and do that. But I've really had to play around with getting more heat on the thicker parts and a little less heat on the other parts. Are there some meats that you take a little more attention like that?
More finesse. Yeah. Seafood in particular takes a lot of attention and a lot of working with. I would say for chicken, you know, Americans have this fascination with breasts, chicken breast. I guess both, to be fair. But we have this fascination with chicken breasts as the meat of choice, but it's really the worst part of the chicken. In terms of flavor, maybe in terms of health, it's fine, but really it's the least flavorful part of the bird. The legs and the thighs are totally where it's at. So especially on the grill, I mean, if you put a chicken breast on the grill, it's too thick. It dries out too much on the outside. It's, by the time you get it cooked all the way through, it's so dried out. My recommendation is go legs and thighs if you're going for chicken, and you end up with a much moister bird and much more flavor too.
What would you recommend for fish that works well on the grill? Because fish can really fall apart.
Yeah, I don't normally cook fish on a grill, and it doesn't hold up well. But also, like, it's basically, if you want to cook something on a grill, it's got to have a ton of fat. So the things, like I said, like big pork and beef do great. If you really want to do fish on the grill, definitely skin on. So like trout, anything you get out of the lake, you know, for the most part, depends on which lake. And then also things like salmon does really great because it has that nice high fat content. So,
do you put it right on the grill, or are you putting it in foil and then on the grill?
No, I do it right on the grill. The biggest thing that people have a problem with is getting things that stick all the time on their grill.
Mm-hmm.
And
we
actually have a grilling class at Liliana's where we show you all the techniques and stuff you can do to kind of do a better grilling. But the two things that you should always do for your grill is, number one, preheat the ever-loving heck out of it. And then number two, just make sure it's really clean. And the reason why it's important to have a clean grill, it's not so that you get the flavor from other items that were on there, but it's because what that buildup is it's a buildup of carbon, which is an insulator. And so if it's an insulator, it won't transfer heat, and that'll cause sticking. So by cleaning your grill, that removes all the carbon that's on your metal, and therefore it'll get a better sear.
We're talking right now with Dave Heide, and we're learning about grilling and smoking. Here we are in the height of grilling season, learning how to grill and smoke meat and learning about what fish to use on the grill. And so, Dave, wondering what you think about the essential tools for grilling. What do we need when we are around the grill?
Number one is a grill brush, again, to keep your grill clean. And then tongs are great. Weber has a great one that I use when I'm outdoor grilling that's got a flat spatula on either side, so it's a lot easier for grilling and turning. Skewers are fantastic. But, you know, really, grilling, again, we talked about primal earlier. just use your hands, you know? I mean, it's great.
Especially if you have, you know, like, asbestos-covered hands.
No,
right?
You just have chef hands. That's what
chef
we do.
Hands.
They're all covered in calluses.
My mother had chef hands, so I can appreciate that. So I think people worry that they're not going to cook something long enough because it looks like it's done on the outside, especially if it's at high heat and stuff, and it's not going to be done. Some people are really kind of obsessed with checking the progress of food on the grill. And if the grill is closed and you keep opening it, is that a bad thing? Is that like opening the oven too often?
Yes and no. It depends on the kind of grill you have. I think one of the biggest things that happens when you open up the grill, yes, it releases heat, which just means it'll take longer. But the biggest problem is that all of that smokiness from the fat dripping down, when the fat drips down onto the fire and releases all that smoke, that kind of gives it that smoky flavor. And when we open up the grill, then all that smoke kind of goes out. So you're not really smoking your meat when you cook it on a grill, but you're definitely imparting that smoky flavor, which again, I think is why we want it on the grill in the first place, is for the flavor.
You said smoking and flavor, and I just have to get to these smoked ribs that you shared with us. Break down this recipe for us. Tell us what's in it.
So the biggest thing with ribs, and so the recipe that I gave you guys is a great recipe, but really, honestly, even if it's just oil, salt, and pepper, the most important thing when you're smoking ribs is just how you smoke it. I know a lot of people are intimidated by smoking because they don't have a smoker, they don't do it very often, but the most important thing when you're smoking is just really nice, low heat for a nice, long period of time. You can absolutely smoke something in a 350-degree oven with smoke going around it and cook it in that same amount of time that you'd cook a regular piece of meat on a grill. But the whole thing that's great about smoking is that really low heat with smoke for a long period of time. So,
and do you use, there are a lot of herbs in your recipe. Do you use all dried herbs for the rub?
For the rub, yes. And again, because we're doing that kind of long smoke, we kind of make a paste out of the spices and herbs. And then rub them on. So you want kind of a dried herb because it'll soak up some of that oil that's in that marinade and kind of help it form into that paste to help it hold on while it's smoking.
Even if I have fresh oregano in the garden?
You can use whatever makes you happy.
No, I want
words
it from the
live
chef.
By,
yes, yes.
I personally would still use that and then save the fresh, beautiful oregano for something else.
All right. Well, do you do anything to the ribs before you put the rub on them?
Great question. You know, some people are, you know, diehard briners. They really think you should brine them first. Some people braise them first before they put them in a smoker. I'm just a purist. I like it just with a rub on it and then in the smoker, slow and low.
Slow and low for about 2 hours.
More longer. Yeah, probably like around like 6 hours.
6 hours.
Yeah, like around 6 hours for a nice low smoke. Now, again, that's if you're smoking it at like 220 degrees. Now, if you're smoking it at like 250 or 275, like if you don't have a temperature regulation, then you're going to want to, you know, do it for a shorter period.
Do they need to rest then at all?
Smoking is different than cooking a grill. So if you're cooking it on a grill, then absolutely it needs to rest. If it's coming off a smoker, you take it and you just saw into it and gnaw into it.
We're listening back to a conversation about grilling and smoking meat on this Food Friday. Coming up, we'll also talk about veggies and fruit on the grill. Dave Heide has great tips and tricks to grill like a pro. He's executive chef and owner of Charlie's on Main in Oregon and Liliana's in Fitchburg. And we want to hear about your grilling achievements. What do you like to grill? Have you smoked meat before? Did you get the outcome you hoped for? Do you have any family recipes that you can share for smoking and grilling meat, fish, or veggies or fruit? Tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. Rob Ferret will be back on Monday. Right now, we're continuing a previous Food Friday conversation that Kate Archer-Kent and I had a while back. We're getting the scoop on grilling and smoking meat with Chef Dave Heide. He's executive chef and owner of Charlie's on Main in Oregon and Liliana's in Fitchburg. And you can join in by tweeting us at Central Time WPR. How often do you cook outdoors? What do you love to throw on the grill? Have you learned any tricks through trial and error? Something we like to talk about less is cleaning the grill. How good are you about not skipping that step? Join the conversation by tweeting us at Central Time WPR.
Let's go right to the phones now with Julie. Hi, Julie.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Go ahead.
Well, first I want to clarify, cleaning grills is not my thing. That is not in my job description.
Nice.
But my family loves to grill, and we love the taste of the meat that's been smoked or done over a flame. So a few years ago, I decided to really push the envelope and start experimenting with larger cuts of meat, like roast. And we have discovered that a lamb roast done on the grill is absolutely the best thing in the whole world. It's super easy, it's tender, and there's so much fat in lamb that you kind of don't have to do anything.
Mm. Yeah, a great cut of lamb that I love is the lamb belly, and the belly actually does a really great job of, you kind of roll it up just like you would kind of like a pork belly, but it's got enough fat in it that it really goes through. Some of the other roasts, like the leg and whatnot, does pretty well. One of the things that you want to really think about when you're doing something on the grill is that it's really hard on most grills to really regulate temperature well. And when you have something like a big roast, it really wants to have that slow and low cooking. So especially like a leg, it really wants to be cooked for like, you know, 2 to 4 hours on a lower heat to really get that elastin to break down. So I think there's some great cuts of lamb to go on there. Same thing with other big roasts. I think they're great, but you really want to make sure you're picking something that's not tough and chewy to begin with, or it's going to still be tough and chewy when you pull it off a regular grill.
Julie, thanks so much for calling in with your question. And Chef Dave, I know we have a number of vegetarians out there. What about cooking veggies on the grill or perhaps tofu?
Yeah, totally. You know, we do, we have a whole vegetarian vegan menu at both Liliana's and Charlie's. My whole family is vegetarian, so we definitely pick up on that. You know, I think the best thing for me, always like corn and peppers and onions and doing a whole big saute, mushrooms. Mushrooms are like the steak of the vegetarian world. So so definitely any kind of mushroom period is great for me.
Do you marinate vegetables or brush them with anything?
I do a lot of that post-grilling. Hmm. If you put, I had someone who asked me earlier about flare-ups on the grill.
that would be me. Full disclosure, I have actually lost entire meals in a fiery inferno.
One of the things that causes a flare-up is too much grease on your produce or on your meat that happens. And so if you marinate your vegetables ahead of time too much, you can end up with a lot of flare. So if you are going to marinate your vegetables, I recommend doing it with like balsamic vinegar and herbs and spices and maybe a little bit of oil. Mm-hmm. And then if you want more oil flavor, then put that on at the end after you've cooked
more of a finish in that way.
Hmm. Let's go to the calls again. Bruce in Cable. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. I was up in Alaska visiting, and they have smoked salmon up there, very popular, especially for the locals. They call it squaw candy, and it's a real sweet smoked salmon. And I'm just wondering how I could do that on my home grill or my home, back here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, so smoking fish is a little different than smoking meats. Usually when you do smoked fish, you'll want to do it over cold smoke. So that's when you have the smoke, instead of directly over flame and smoke, you have the smoke come up from a separate chamber and go in. So cold smoke doesn't mean it's like 32 degrees when it's smoking. It just means that it's a much cooler smoke than directly over flame. So that's how I do our smoked fish. If you have a gas smoker, you can also set it at a really, really, really low flame. But again, when you're trying to get enough, the problem is if you try and smoke a fish, if you do it on a high heat, it's not going to get any smoke flavor before it dries out and becomes overcooked. So you want to have something that can have a really low temp.
Mm, well, great. What about pudding?
Pudding doesn't work very well.
What about fruit on the grill? Sweet endings. I know.
Good.
You want to put a peach on the grill or some
pineapple.
Pineapple.
Yeah, actually, peach and pineapple are two of my favorites for grilling. Watermelon does a really good job. But wait.
Watermelon on the grill?
Yeah, watermelon on the grill. It's really good. But you have to do really clean, really hot grill and just kind of flash it. And if you cook it for too long, it'll break down. So it's just to give it that little bit of smoke and then hit with a little bit of salt right afterwards. And it brings out the sweetness. It's great.
That sounds really good. Well, so we've been talking so much about that flavor that's imparted by smoke. What about wood chips? Do you use wood chips for smoking in when you're just regular grilling, or do you feel like that's just kind of icing on cake that's not needed?
Wood chips, absolutely, for smoking. That's where we get all of our smoke flavor from. It depends on what kind of smoker you have. If you have one of those really big smokers, some of them use pellets, some of them use like wood chunks, some of them use chips. Most of mine use chips. Just remember to soak your chips ahead of time. That's what's going to make them actually smoke and not just burn. So you want to, make them last a lot longer as well. So you just want to make sure if you are going to use chips that you do let them soak first.
So use them just with the smoker, or can you also use chips on your grill?
If you use chips on the grill, it's mostly just going to make some smoke. Again, you know, the way you impart smoked flavor on something is a long exposure to that smoke. Just taking, you know, a little bit of fire underneath with a little bit of smoke isn't really going to change the flavor that much. If you want to add a little bit of smoky flavor and you don't have an outdoor smoker and you want to do it at home, one thing you can do is you can get two pots. And you can put the range on low, put some moist wood chips in the bottom with foil protecting your pot, and then just put it right on your range and let the temperature come up until you start to see a little bit of smoke. Put a rack in there, and then you can put another pot or aluminum foil over the top and just keep an eye and that it's on low heat, and you can end up smoking your own food in your house.
Keep an eye on it.
And probably run the fan
above. And keep your fan going.
Well, let's go to Gary now in Rhinelander. Hi, Gary.
Hi there. I am definitely a solid charcoal griller. I mean, I don't like gas grill. Otherwise, you might as well just do it in the house is the way I look at it. But on a charcoal grill, I mean, we charcoal steaks very often, and it doesn't take more than about 7 minutes to do the steaks that we get, and because we like them medium to medium rare and such, and it's got a great flavor. We charcoal out year-round. And 2 years ago, I'd received an electric smoker, which, okay, wasn't so happy about electric, but my wife uses it often only because she has the time, and she makes, I mean, ribs that you would die for. I mean, we go about 145 degrees in our electric smoker for about 4 hours. And we do four slabs at a time. And then we let it rest and cool it in tin foil. And then we will rewarm it up in the oven for about 45 minutes. And it is comes off the bone just like you want it to.
That sounds great, Gary. And so, Dave, electric smoker, charcoal grill, we didn't actually talk about the different options.
So charcoal grills, I absolutely love. They're great. I think the biggest inconvenience is the inconvenience. You know, you've got to wait for them to...
The timing,
the preheating, and also inconsistency in temperatures that goes around. Flavor-wise, I think it's great. But I think a lot of... what makes people love charcoal is the nostalgia of growing up with charcoal. You know, when you grew up tasting charcoal with the family, and again, that whole social aspect we talked about before, you know, when you grew up and that was what it was, when you tasted that charcoal, it was being with your family. A lot of people impart those feelings into the grill as well. So in terms of an electric smoker, electric smokers are fine. In Wisconsin, the only thing I don't recommend about an electric smoker is that they have a much harder time keeping temperature consistent compared to a gas smoker. So if you're looking at a gas smoking purchase, I would or a smoker purchase for outdoors, I would definitely recommend a gas one over electric. But electric is great, too. It just means you have a shorter season, so you won't be able to go out in, you know, 18 degree below zero weather and smoke.
And Carly in Cumberland, Wisconsin, wants is vegan and wants some vegan grilling ideas.
Some other vegan grilling ideas? We could, well, so so we make our own seitan from scratch at Liliana's. And seitan does a really good job on the grill, and you can even smoke it really well. We've done smoked seitan at our restaurant. And that turns out really good. We also, at both our restaurants, we have smoked tofu, and the smoked tofu is incredibly good. We pan sear it. It's got chimichurri, and it's really good. So, you know, taking some, I don't recommend using any of the, like, pre-purchased fake meats when you're smoking. They work fine on a grill, but they don't really do that good a job in a smoker.
Can you leave us with one key piece of advice before we go fire up the grill, perhaps tonight?
Clean your grill, clean your grill, clean your grill. And then don't forget to clean your grill.
How clean is clean?
Oh, my God, clean your grill. No, so, like, you have to just clean the grill so that there's no carbon buildup.
Okay.
Because every single person who says, my meat sticks, I'm just like, just clean your grill. And they clean it, and they're like, oh, my God, it fixed it. And I'm like, yeah. And then, yeah.
Well, Chef Dave, thank you so much for joining us.
Of course. More than happy to.
That was a Past Food Friday conversation that Kate Archer Kent and I had with Dave Heide. He's executive chef and owner of Charlie's on Main in Oregon and Liliana's in Fitchburg. He shared some great tips for delicious grilled and smoked meat, also grilling fruits and vegetables. And if you really want to make Chef Dave happy, please clean your grill. You can keep the conversation going by tweeting us at Central Time WPR. Do you love to grill? What's your favorite meat to prepare? What about veggies or even fruit? Are you going to try that grilled watermelon? I think I am. Share your favorites with us by tweeting us at Central Time WPR. Extra points for sharing photos of your grilled masterpieces. Well, it's finally happened. As the New York Times article was titled, "The Long, Monstrous Reign of the Red Delicious Apple is Ending." The U.S. Apple Association recently released its forecast for apple production this year, and after decades at number one, the Red Delicious is set to be toppled from the top spot by the Gala variety. Apple experts say that U.S. consumers now have so many choices of apples that people can actually pick one based on their likes and dislikes when it comes to texture and whether it's more tart or sweet. Granny Smith, Fuji, and Honeycrisp apples are expected to rank third, fourth, and fifth, respectively. But Honeycrisp's growing popularity could vault it into second place in just a few years, according to the Apple Association. So get set for that showdown. Don't expect the Red Delicious to disappear, though. While short on flavor, it does travel and keep well, so it's likely to stay a favorite with schools and hospitals, and it's also a big export item. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll check up on the latest in the race for governor with the state capitol reporter. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.